With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us this morning on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, USDA researchers have confirmed 6 unique strains of African swine fever virus. Also hear how the weather in 2023 took a significant toll on table grapes. And our top story today is a look at the weather and what's expected around the nation. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says near to below normal temperatures and precipitation are expected for much of the country for the next week.
We are looking at a relatively tranquil pattern continuing across much of the country, with the majority of areas experiencing near or below normal temperatures and near or below normal precipitation. Now, we do have a couple of exceptions. We should see some mild weather across the Pacific coast states and the nation's northern tier as far east as the far upper Midwest, also seeing some lingering warm weather across southern Florida. Then in terms of wetter than normal conditions, it'll be a pretty focused area across the deep south, primarily from southeastern Arizona all the way to the southern Atlantic coast. And with that precipitation pattern, that could be an early sign that El Nino is starting to take the reins of weather patterns, as southern wetness is a hallmark of El Nino during the wintertime.
Among the most long-standing membership organizations in agriculture, Holstein Association USA has been driven by dairy farmer leaders for more than 140 years. Bob Cervera catches up with a few individuals who have contributed to the association's success over the years.
Just like its membership, Holstein Association USA leaders come from all backgrounds and farm sizes. Past president Gordy Cook milks about 65 cows and runs an ice cream stand in Massachusetts. He says he made sure he never forgot where he came from while he served his 2 terms as association president.
When I ran, I hoped that I could make a difference and be a representative from a section of the industry and ask for the vote. As somebody who realized that there was bigger farms and smaller farms, and that I needed to serve them all and make them all try to be profitable.
Gordy says he enjoyed traveling and getting to know fellow dairy farmers from across the nation and throughout the world. But one aspect about being a Holstein Association USA president sticks out more than anything else.
There's nobody on the board ever that I don't have the highest respect for and appreciation of, and I consider a lot of them my friends.
Boyd Schaufelberger of Illinois, who served as president from 2017 to 2019, echoes Gordy's thoughts about the people he served.
The interaction at conventions is probably the favorite time, because I love being able to talk to members. The ability to make friends and interact with people is really the highlight of that.
Recent years have brought unprecedented progress for the dairy industry. For instance, the genetic and genomic information age blossomed during Chuck Warden's presidential watch. A dairy producer from New York, he says he worked closely with Association CEO John Meyer to make the advancements accessible for dairy breeders.
John and I spent a lot of time working with USDA and the council to try and get that done right. I feel that the effort that we put into it was really important, and that was probably the biggest thing that I did in my time.
Although the people who serve as Holstein Association USA president changes by design, the goal is always the same.
I always had a real feeling of passion for making sure that what was going on in the industry was relevant to Holstein, or Holstein was relevant to the industry. And that was a big part of the feelings I had.
And there's good reason to continue to believe in a promising future for the association.
There's a lot of good leadership in this organization, so I feel really good about its future.
For Holstein Association USA, I'm Bob Cervera.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halvorsen. We will return in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports, including our livestock report with Will Jordan, when we return. You are listening to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halvorsen. In today's National Spotlight, I stopped by the U.S. Grains Council booth at the National Association of Farm Broadcasting annual convention. Here is the conversation I had.
Brent Boydston, Chairman, U.S. Grains Council.
What is going on with U.S. Grains? You were telling me off mic a little bit about a trip that you got to take to China. Tell me more.
Yes, so there is a lot going on right now in the global trade market, but we did spend a week in China. We spent a few days in Beijing, a few days in Shanghai. It was part of a broader cooperator group.
So there are a lot of opportunities in China. What were some exciting things that you learned or talked about while you were on your trip?
So To say China is exciting is a bit of an understatement, and I do have to preface that with, we talk a lot about China, but until you're in China, you can't really understand China. Just the growth, the people, the population that they have, and what that means. When you look at it, that is big potential. They're wanting to grow their domestic hog population. They're wanting to grow the relationship, the agricultural trade relationship between the United States. And those are all very exciting opportunities for U.S. corn, barley, and sorghum.
Going on trips like this to China, how important would you say that kind of work is for our grains?
Incredibly important. We met with government agencies and business partners in Beijing, and then we went to the CII, so that's China Import Investment Expo in Shanghai. It's a big trade show with about 600,000 people that come through it. And while we were there, you know, we continued the meetings, but we also met with Ambassador Nick Burns, who's the U.S. ambassador to China. He wants to grow the agricultural trade relationship. So that was great to see. We continued to meet with our partners in Shanghai for the benefit of U.S. corn farmers. And what we saw is definitely an interest from the Chinese to continue to grow and this relationship that we have.
Any other trips coming up that you would like to talk about?
Sure. So we're going to have we're going to be shifting gears a little bit. We're going to be headed to Senegal here in December. So we not only work in established markets. So right now, Grains Council, we have a presence in 60 different countries. Southeast Asia being probably the largest, along with Latin and South America. But we also work in frontier markets as well, and these are markets that. They're not huge buyers right now, but there's good potential. And we're going to be headed to Senegal, which is in West Africa. And we are starting to see U.S. Corn products go into Senegal. There's a potential for U.S. ethanol there. But this is where the development of relationships is important, because business deals are done on trust. And when you can shake someone's hand, that starts to developing the trust, and they can work with our staff in Africa to further that market penetration.
What did you call? Did you call that a frontier market?
You can call it frontier market, developing market, emerging market. So frontier markets are great, but these are markets that are new. It's where you haven't had a presence before. We haven't had a large presence in Western Africa. So Grains Council, Morocco, Tunisia, Egypt, that North Africa region is where we've always had our largest presence. In the last 5 to 6 years, we've developed a presence in Tanzania and Kenya, in West Africa. We've also had a presence in South Africa as well. So that leaves West Africa. And there hasn't been a lot of opportunities to get into these markets, but they're starting to develop now. And Africa is going to be one of those places that, quite frankly, we need to keep an eye on, and we need to develop those relationships, because when you look at the population, they're increasing not only in number, but they're also increasing financially, and they're wanting to shift from those vegetable proteins, those plant-based proteins. They want to shift to animal-based proteins. Largely, chicken is what we're seeing right now. And in fact, Grains Council works with the Moroccan Poultry Association on a training program so that nominees from various African sub-Saharan countries can go. They can learn about poultry production from egg to the container, all of the parts in between. But while they're doing it, they're using U.S. corn, U.S. sorghum, U.S. DDGs. And so they develop the knowledge of those feedstuffs, and then those feedstuffs will eventually end up into those markets in those countries.
Is there anything else that you think our listeners should know about what you're doing, or about just grain trade in general?
So we're just we're out there working. We have a great staff. Like I said, we have a presence in 60 different countries to develop those markets and enabling trade and improving lives.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Roel Jordan with today's livestock report.
In today's livestock news, as we move into late November, there's been pressure on the feeder cattle market. Yet as temperatures cool off, markets should stay steady with potential for prices to begin heating up. Holden Ramey, market analyst for Cattle Facts, shares more.
Over the last couple of weeks here, obviously there's been quite a bit of pressure in the feeder cattle market. That kind of started right before the last cattle on feed report. You know, well, there was a lot of uncertainty surrounding placements, and placements ended up coming in quite a bit above industry expectations there for the month of September. ended up coming in up 6%. I think the top placement estimate was there around 5%, so that was a little bit of a surprise to the industry, and ultimately that's what led to both feeder cattle and calves coming under a little bit of pressure. I think there was some uncertainty, especially over those couple of weeks there, of people in barns that were buying cattle, so that kind of pressured prices here. But marching forward here, I think feeder cattle complex in general has put in a pretty significant low. Does appear to be that we're through a significant part of the fall run. As far as calves go here, just looking at a U.S. average 550 price, do think as we go throughout November and December, prices should be supported around that 275. We are waiting for some moisture to come across the central and southern plains, especially in those major wheat growing areas. If we do get that, do think calf prices could even push higher, up towards 300. Again, the U.S. average here, just looking at a U.S. average 550 price. Do think as we go throughout November and December, prices should be supported around that 275. We are waiting for some moisture to come across the central and southern plains, especially in those major wheat growing areas. If we do get that, do think calf prices could even push higher, up towards 300, again, the U.S. average. But that kind of remains to be seen. It's certainly in the forecast, but we'll have to see if that comes to fruition. As we push deeper into the winter, calves will stay, again, I think generally supported there. Probably will start to gain a little momentum from a seasonal standpoint after you get past the first of the year. Should be expecting trade there on those, again, 550 weight calves on a U.S. average, around $300, $100 weight. Switching gears a little bit, looking at feeders. Again, we've kind of hamstrung those the last couple of weeks, just in the marketplace. But do think they'll stay pretty supported here just because we are in the time of year where we have declining seasonal supplies.
For AgNet West, I'm Will Jordan.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's Brian German.
Export markets for California pistachios are vital, with demand remaining high in some key destinations. President of American Pistachio Growers, Richard Matoyan, said the European Union is still the number one destination for exports, with growth seen in other markets as well.
China and Hong Kong used to be our number one export destination, but now are number two. The export numbers continue to rise there. This is like the third year in a row that we've seen more exports go to that part of the world. Also, we saw a market that we started promoting in 2019, India. We saw shipments there rise dramatically by 143%. Now, while the total number of pounds is still relatively low, about 41 million pounds, it's a market that we see tremendous growth and opportunity in the next several years.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture's Agricultural Research Service has reclassified the number of African swine fever virus strains from 25 to 6 genotypes. The reevaluation, based on a comprehensive analysis of over 12,000 virus isolates using the CINET supercomputer cluster, revealed that the previously identified genotypes were inaccurately classified. The reduction in unique genotypes suggests less diversity in the virus worldwide. ARS believes the finding may streamline vaccine development by reducing the number of vaccines needed to protect against virus genotypes. Accurate classification is crucial for investigations and cost-effective countermeasures such as vaccine design. Despite the ASFV causing economic losses globally, there has yet to be any outbreaks in the United States. A disconnect between federal agencies is a core issue in how the Endangered Species Act is considered in reviews of crop protection materials. President and CEO of the Almond Alliance, Aubrey Betancourt, said the EPA is caught between a rock and a hard place.
They take forever to do endangered species reviews. It's true. That's why they were sued over it. But the lawsuit now has, I think, bound up the agency where they're looking for any kind of solution that just keeps them out of a lawsuit again. That's fine. I understand the motivation for that. I understand that we absolutely should do ESA reviews on these products and on these chemistries. We should do that. However, that means you should also acknowledge the authority of the agency to do that. So we have this weird kind of disconnect where Fish and Wildlife can totally acknowledge EPA's authority to set certain stipulations on products and uses, but EPA has no way of acknowledging Fish and Wildlife's conservation agreements, safe harbor agreements, or the work that they do with landowners.
Weather in 2023 took its toll on California grapes. Adam Borchard with the California Fresh Fruit Association said that initially the season was looking promising this year.
In early June, we were looking at an estimate of approximately 97 million boxes for the table grape industry, which is on par with where we've been in the past few years. Then unfortunately, in the middle of August, there were huge impacts by Hurricane Hillary. In the southern San Joaquin Valley, we saw anywhere between 1 and 3 inches of rain with substantial wind gusts. So impacts were great enough that the late August revised estimate for the table grape industry was 72 million boxes, which is about a 25 to 30% decrease from our recent averages for annual harvest yields. And it's our lowest volume estimate since 1994.
UC Agriculture and Natural Resources is co-hosting a Sustainable Nutrient Management and Soil Health Field Day next month. The event will take place at two locations on Friday, December 8th. The morning session will take place in the Ag Center Conference Room at the Monterey County Cooperative Extension Office in Salinas. Topics that will be discussed include improving water and nitrogen use efficiency, Ag Order 4.0 updates, soil health initiatives, and winter cover crop impacts on soil water movement. The afternoon session will take place at the D'Arrigo Brothers of California. Presentations will be made on irrigation flow meter installation and operation, remote irrigation monitoring with crop manage integration, and soil carbon monitoring using infield sensors. More information about the field day is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
What to do instead of tossing those leftovers that were left over too long. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. Are there some Thanksgiving leftovers that will stick around in your refrigerator too long? Experts at the University of Florida Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences suggest you compost it instead of just throwing it away. They say all it takes to compost is a small designated space where food waste, plant clippings, and even manure can be layered and combined with water and the air we breathe. Together, they're all wrapped up in a composting bin designed to keep pests out and food wastes away from landfills. Composting provides several benefits, including relieving many of the current environmental issues triggered by the reduction of public recycling programs and demands for more landfills. Food is the most common material sent to landfills, comprising 24.1% of municipal solid waste in the United States, according to the EPA. You can head to this story on our website for more information on how to start composting. That's agnetwest.com. This is the Agnet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour. Does holiday shopping dig you into a financial hole every year? Gary Crawford has an expert who can help us stay out of that trouble.
It's time for holiday shopping.
How much have you done?
I've done quite a bit, actually.
Well, the fun has just begun.
Actually, it began early this year. And Matt Shea with the National Retail Federation is expecting a big increase in holiday gift spending this year.
Between 3 and 4%. Above last year's holiday season.
And some consumer financial experts are already voicing concerns that with what seems to be a willingness to spend big this year, that maybe there's going to be a lot of people spending a lot of money they don't have and getting into a lot of financial trouble.
I used to work retail before I did this, and I also worked in a bank before this. So I've seen it from a lot of different sides.
Yes, she has. That's Elizabeth Kish. She is now a Kansas State University Extension family finance expert. And she says for some people like me, maybe, and she says like her, maybe, holiday shopping and buying is almost like an addiction.
Even though I know what my limits are, there's just something about it. You really do get this hit and it feels good.
Wow! I feel good.
Thank you, James. But then when the money runs out and or the bills come in later, it's not so good. So Elizabeth Kish says to avoid what for some can be a true financial disaster, first rule is the one that Santa follows.
Oh, definitely. Yes, I am a firm believer in lists.
And putting a firm spending limit on that list. Now, every year I spend way too much. So before we went on here, Elizabeth, you said for me to ask myself a question.
What is the minimum that we need to have a joyous holiday? For most people, it's way less than what they're actually thinking they need to do.
Really? Okay. So once I've introduced the gift list to the budget list, then, Elizabeth, I suppose I have to actually sort of stick to the budget?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So how do I figure that out? I mean, what can I do to help me make sure that I don't go over that spending limit?
Don't substitute credit for cash.
Cash? What a concept. Otherwise, though, you say I'm going to be getting back on this thing here. Yeah, the treadmill to financial oblivion, a vicious cycle like this.
I don't have the cash for the holiday, so I put it on my credit card. I'm just going to ride it out until February when I can file my income tax, and then I use the majority of the refund to put down my credit card bill. I may not always pay it all off. I've been still paying my credit card from the last two holidays.
How did she get into my head like that? So, all right, I've made the list, I have pared it down to something manageable, and I'm leaving the credit cards locked up someplace. So now, can I go shopping, please?
Okay, go shop.
Okay, I am gone. Thank you.
You're welcome.
This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Brian German joins us once again with this interview.
We're joined by Joshua Ram this morning, Director of Technical and Regulatory Affairs for the California Walnut Board and Commission. And today we're talking about some opportunities for walnut growers to help get some support with climate smart ag practices, which have been more and more highlighted and popular in recent years. And so let's get right into it with what this new funding resource is.
Yeah, Brian, exactly right. And a couple things here with some challenges currently being faced. You know, the state already in a $31+ billion budget, coupling that with a $40 million shortage due to legislative errors for the CDFA's Healthy Soils Program, which is typically a staple program for the walnut industry. We've worked on securing funding and collaborative opportunities through another avenue that I strongly encourage all walnut growers take advantage of in order to help offset costs for their operations and some of these practices. This would be A Vibrant Future is the title of the project. It's a USDA Climate Smart Pilot Program working via industry partners. There's up to $15 million in funding available. A couple things on this project are it's really the goal of these USDA Climate Smart Pilot Programs are to facilitate the implementation of climate smart production practices and to develop robust tools to measure inputs, outputs and yields and put in place systems for verification, traceability and marketing of climate smart commodities. Some practices that are available for growers to trial as part of this program are short season cover crops, nutrient management, residue and tillage management, alley cropping, water management, soil amendments and mulches. A couple expectations of the project participants for growers. Each grower is expected to participate in the program for 4 years and to commit to the implementation of one of the climate smart practices. As I mentioned, the growers will make implementation sites available or their orchards available to data and information collected no more than twice a year. For production suppliers, each supplier or vendor is expected to participate in the program for 4 years as well, and be willing to provide technical site-specific support throughout the process. There's a couple other benefits for participants that include assistance with the development of personalized plans for the implementation of climate smart practices, access to a certified crop advisor and sustainability consultants, subscription to a software data platform, and partial offset of direct costs involved in implementation of climate smart practices. Also of note are a modest cash incentive for participation and data collected on the farm site is benchmarked against aggregated data. So this is a good potential opportunity for those farmers and growers out there looking for additional funding for their climate smart practices. Funding is up to $15 million. As I mentioned, the first group will consist of 20 growers, and it's first come, first serve. So be sure to get signed up as soon as you can. And there will be a second group with a longer list of participants eligible here in the future. Those dates will be coming out soon. Can apply now, and there'll be a link that'll be shared. And if you have any further questions, feel free to contact myself at jrahm@walnuts.org.
And now, you noted as part of participating in the program, there's an expectation of reporting some of that data that's recorded there. And I would assume, just because of concerns regarding data and privacy, this information will be aggregated in some fashion and kept private for individual growers, right?
Absolutely. You yourself will have access as the grower to your data. However, any other data there is aggregated and anonymized, so there won't be any issues with confidentiality. It will be secured and confidential.
This is the AgNet News Hour. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. Today's interview segment comes to us from the 2023 Ag Gateway Annual Conference held this month in Nashville, Tennessee. Here's Cindy Zimmerman.
First, introduce yourself, please.
Yeah, I'm Brooks Hamilton, and I've been working on in the realm of AI for about 20 years, before AI was cool, and from Austin, Texas.
Well, here you're here at the Ag Gateway Annual Meeting in Nashville. Why did you think this would be a great opportunity for you to be able to speak to a group like This Works in Agriculture?
Yeah, I think this is a tremendously innovative group. I've worked with a number of other industries where they struggle with data challenges, and I've been especially impressed with the leadership that Ag Gateways provided for this industry to go about sorting out some of those really thorny issues, which others just kind of leave for somebody else to resolve without actually doing anything about it. So I thought this would just be a great group of doers to work with.
What were some of your main messages that you want to get across?
I think that it is, we're looking at a truly fundamentally different occurrence. You know, we've heard about the wonder or possibility of AI for a long time, but it's never really materialized right up until now. And so the other is, like, how do I actually incorporate this in my business today and for the years that come?
A couple of the things that you, I was really interested in your presentation, but one of the things that really, really hit me was how AI doesn't depend on infrastructure investments and how it's easier than to get it out than most other things. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So when we've had prior technology revolutions like the iPhone, the internet itself, or PCs, we had to do a tremendous number of things to make that successful. Whereas in the realm of AI, there are a few companies that need to make big investments, but everybody else essentially is able to use it really quickly after that. So we would expect this, both because it's so impactful and because it's so easy to access, to go quickly.
You talked about some of the areas that you think that AI will be good with in agriculture. Obviously, they've already using it in some ways. But what are some of the areas that you see in agriculture where it's going to be useful?
Yeah, I think that when I look at these opportunities, there are two main types. It's my primary business, and in agriculture, certainly for growers, that is going to be really related to much more in the realm of robotics. However, there are all of the other operational items. When do I buy? When do I plant? Operational questions, transportation, logistics, and then all the administrivia that goes with it. Those are the areas that I think can be made to be much more autonomous and more automated, so that growers and others in the ag industry, just in general, can focus on the parts of why they got into it rather than all of the other ancillary things.
How do you think AI can help this group in terms of you know, standardization, and especially internationally, how is AI going to help them reach that goal?
Yeah, I think the international part is really phenomenal. Mm-hmm. If we think about like language translation, mm-hmm. that's always been so hard. Mm-hmm. And we use like prior products like Google Translate, and everybody's like, ugh, it's just mm-hmm. not great. But now we can get it done at scale and cheaply mm-hmm. in as many different languages as we would like. So that really helps when we're thinking about how we're going to go about selling overseas and creating not terrible like product descriptions or being able to correspond with others. That is really going to get addressed. Then, you know, when you also talk about data standardization, mm-hmm. that's a really wonderful thing about AI. And these techniques is that the applications can actually come to understand what the products are in terms of description, what's been written about them, and then also what they look like. Images is something that they can then take into account. So, you know, that's something we just haven't had available before. So instead of trying to match one code against another code, you have like a product ID. You instead have an application which really fundamentally understands thing A and thing B are just the same thing. And, you know, that it can help solve all kinds of data consistency issues.
Do you think that there is fear of AI on the part of companies adopting it?
I think that the fear part can come from a few different directions. One is certainly people as they think about what are my future job prospects. And in some roles, I don't think there's going to be any impact. It's just going to be things will be easier. Like if I'm an outside sales rep, well, I'd love for somebody else to take my notes and enter things into CRM because I hate that part of my job. I like working with people. Whereas others who are really kind of doing a lot of Excel work or data entry, that might look pretty different going forward. It could be that that's just a review aspect of things, and that might not take as many people. So, you know, there is fear around that. And then we also have to, when I think about the fear at executive levels, it is, how am I going to need to change my organization so that I can take advantage of or respond to the changes that are coming and the new capabilities that are coming? So they may be looking at a level of change and the pace of change that has just not been prevalent beforehand, which can cause a lot of heartburn.
Well, and the fear apparently can be, am I going to have a job? But one of the things you pointed out is there's going to be jobs that aren't going to be impacted by AI, right?
That's right. There will definitely be jobs, I think, that aren't. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that may become kind of cheap or devalued is things like, hey, I can match two things together, or I can create a simple software program. And what might become a lot more valuable is, am I good at speaking person to person and establishing trust? Am I able to really talk to an irate customer and kind of talk them off the ledge? You know, those are much more likely to be the things which we find valuable that just can't be done in an automated fashion.
Right. Like that salesperson. You're still going to need a human salesperson to go out and make sales, right?
That's exactly right.
All right, that's really all the questions I have. Is there anything else you want to add?
I've so enjoyed the session, and part of that is the great team here and super nice attendees. They asked some fantastically bright questions.
All right, thank you very much. Here at the Ag Gateway Annual Meeting in Nashville, I'm Cindy Zimmerman.
This is the AgNet News Hour. We will return in just a moment with more agriculture news. You're listening to the AgNet News Hour, and now for more news. Canada has a new apple variety that is a hit with consumers. Dennis Guy has more.
One of Canada's largest apple producers, Algoma Orchards, based near Newcastle, just east of Toronto on the north shore of Lake Ontario, has launched a new premium consumer apple. The new variety was launched in October and has become a fast favorite in grocery stores and with consumers. Branded and trademarked Snowflake Kirk Kemp of Algoma Orchards said the journey from grafting the initial seed stock in his orchard to growing out the trees all the way to selling wholesale at grocery stores started 20 years ago. Kemp says he took a trip across Canada to look for seed stock at Agriculture Canada's Apple Research Station in Summerlin, British Columbia.
20 years ago, I went out to a research station in Summerlin, BC. I brought back 10 apples from 5 different varieties. I had to talk to AgriFood Canada to see if they would give me a test license and graft them on a tree to grow them in our climate. Summerlin's more of a drier climate than southern Ontario, and apples will end up turning out a little different in a very humid area versus a dry area. So we let them grow there for 4 or 5 years.
Initially, 5 tree grafts were successful, and over the next 20 years, Kemp expanded the number of trees growing what would eventually be called the snowflake apple. Over the years, Kirk Kemp sublicensed a few other apple producers to grow the trees. Kemp says the tree is good in the orchard, and from those 5 grafts, there are now 50,000 trees in 6 orchards across southern Ontario.
The tree grows quite well. We kind of like it in the orchard. It's relatively easy to manage. It's a vigorous tree. It yields quite well, and we've given 4 or 5 growers in southern Ontario the right to grow some of them themselves, so we kind of spread it around a little bit. Between ourselves and the other growers that grow it, we have 50,000. We have another 20,000 coming this spring.
Kemp says the snowflake can be used as a cooking apple, but the market has decided that snowflake is a premium table apple.
It does cook well, but it is mostly a out-of-the-hand eating apple. It's a medium-sized apple. It's very firm. It's quite dense. When you first bite it, it has a little bit of a tang, but then the sweetness comes in after, and it's a very complex flavor, so it's kind of a unique taste. It comes out right near the top, you know, with 20 different varieties in the taste test. We're excited about it.
Algoma Orchards holds the license to produce and market snowflake apples across Canada, while Agriculture Canada's Summerlin Research Station holds the international marketing rights. Reporting from Canada, I'm Dennis Guy.
USDA has a new forecast for 2024 milk production and prices. Gary Crawford reports.
It's like a great unwritten law in the dairy world, and that is that yearly milk production rarely, if ever, goes down from year to year, no matter what the price is. Case in point, USDA's new forecast for 2024 milk output. USDA Outlook Chairman Mark Jekanowski says production is
still expected to grow year over year, up about almost 3 billion pounds.
A 1% increase, but an increase nonetheless. As to expectations for milk prices next year,
our 2024 all milk price is currently forecast at $20.80 per hundredweight. That's up just 10 cents from the current 2023 year.
That would be 0.5% higher than this year, and historically, well, that's a pretty good price.
But feed prices have also been relatively high, so margins are relatively tight as well.
But not tight enough for producers to sell off a lot of cows and cut milk production. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.